Chapter 3, Governing the Navy. Jackson's inaugural address only briefly mentioned the Navy, yet it demonstrated an understanding and respect for the Navy and its role for the nation. As with other departments under his executive branch, the Navy immediately fell under financial scrutiny. He assigned one of his loyalists, Amos Kendall, to investigate its accounts, not to punish the Navy he had inherited from his predecessor, but to better finance it in future years and determine if there was any fraud. To administer his Navy, Jackson selected 3 secretaries over the course of his administration, all of whom had served their states as governors and senators. Though each had lacked naval experience, their combination of executive experience and legislative work on Capitol Hill, voting on Navy budgets, made Jackson's choices wise ones. Jackson's governance of the Navy benefited from his personal expectations of justice, demands for accountability, and preparation for what he envisioned as future operations. He believed the Navy was a vital arm of American commerce and its growing influence. Yet his administration of the Navy, and of the whole of his government, was narrowed by his excessive misplaced sense of honor and justice, as well as his belief that his opinion ought never be challenged. His volatility sometimes undermined the stability of national and naval governance. The debate on the size and form of the Navy had diminished compared to the constitutional debate in 1787. However, the ideas about the purpose, size, and composition of the Navy continued and remains an ongoing discussion in national security circles even in the 21st century. The navalists, those who proposed a standing Navy operating at various global stations, dominated in the post-war of 1812 environment. Anti-navalists were in the minority, but were not silent during Jackson's administration. The anti-navalists supported a more state-based structure for a Navy that would empower individual states to compete on ship designs and needs. The southern states, advocates of a smaller government and decreased federal budgets, as well as commercial markets for cotton, were especially aware of the cost of maintaining a Navy. This would play out during the debate on whether to build the ship of the line USS Pennsylvania in 1835. Despite the limited amount of attention paid to the Navy during his inaugural address, Jackson began his presidency with a basic but essential understanding of the need for the Navy. Jackson demonstrated this understanding and vision in 4 ways. First, he called for a gradual increase in the Navy, a decidedly navalist approach. No anti-navalist would have suggested during peacetime that the Navy remain as large as it was, much less suggest that it grow. What did Jackson foresee that required this gradual increase? Of paramount importance was the protection of America's commerce, whose needs grew with the rapid rise in population. In the 1830s, for example, America had supplanted England as the largest whaling nation. In 1828, the gross tonnage of American merchant ships engaged in whaling was 54,000 gross tons. Whalers were generally a few hundred tons. By 1837, that had increased to 129,000 gross tons. It would finally peak in 1857, when the gross tonnage was 195,000. The total tonnage of U.S. vessels cleared to leave port in 1828 was 897,000, 6 times the number of cleared foreign vessels. In 1836, more than 1.3 million tons of U.S. vessels were cleared to leave port, twice the number of foreign vessels. America's economy also grew with new markets, such as China. Although the first U.S. merchant ship left for China in 1785, American commercial activity in the region demanded the establishment of the last permanent squadron by the end of Jackson's administration. In the 1830s, the American merchant fleet was second in size only to that of England. One indicator of the growth of the merchant fleet during this decade was the total gross tons of documented vessels. In 1830, the merchant fleet totaled 1.2 million gross tons, By 1837, that number had risen to 1.8 million gross tons. The growth was much higher since the 1830s had seen the advent of smaller, more efficient steamships. In 1828, steamships totaled 39,418 tons. By the end of Jackson's second term, that number had grown to 154,765 gross tons. With more ships plying American trade came the threats the country had always faced, such as piracy. The potential for conflict with other powers, particularly the British, whom he had fought against twice, required a standing and growing navy. Second, Jackson recognized that the navy should be more than a coastal defensive force. It needed to display the flag in foreign waters, if not as a global power, then as a force with a global mission to patrol distant waters. Jackson continued the naval expeditions of his predecessors, Madison, Monroe, and Adams, who had supported permanent overseas squadrons in the Caribbean, Pacific, Mediterranean, and elsewhere in the post-war of 1812 environment. Jackson made it clear that the Navy was on distant stations to stay. Third, Jackson knew the power of the rising tide of national patriotic fervor within the young republic. His casual mention of the Navy's fame and arms recognized the crucial role the small Navy had played in the quasi-war with France, the Barbary Wars, and the War of 1812. Though the Navy had lost ships, its single-ship victories against superior powers had been unexpected and gave hope to the nation. In case the country was to engage in naval conflict during his presidency, he committed himself to ensuring the fleet was ready to avoid a reversal of its maritime fortune. Fourth, Jackson proposed the introduction of progressive improvements in the discipline and science. Along with the previous factors, this term would underscore yet another unexpected aspect of Jackson's Navy that was shaped by the previously mentioned new era of naval enlightenment, a professionalization of personnel and liberality of the era's burst of scientific activity. Jackson immediately formed his government and submitted names to the Senate for confirmation. This was his official cabinet. Newspapers would later coin the term kitchen cabinet, for those official and unofficial advisers closest to him. Martin Van Buren, his Secretary of State, had organized the Democrats for Jackson in the 1828 campaign. For Secretary of War, Jackson nominated John Eaton, whom he had served with in the War of 1812 and as U.S. Senators from Tennessee. What would be termed the Eaton Affair would impact Jackson's governance, including that of justice within the Navy. Attorney and marksman Charles Dickinson had made intemperate remarks about Rachel Jackson. This led to a duel in 1806, in which Jackson killed Dickinson. In Jackson's worldview, a wife's honor ought always to be defended. In many ways, it was the same as his position on national security. He sees an offense, and he takes action. So it was with Eaton's wife, Margaret. The then Margaret O'Neill worked in her father's hotel a few blocks from the White House. She was popular and warranted the attention of many sons and nephews of Washington's elites, a fact she fully offered later in life. "I had the attention of men, young and old, enough to turn a girl's head." At the age of 16, she married U.S. Navy purser John Timberlake, a man 20 years her senior. The following year, when he was sworn in as senator, John Eaton began lodging at Franklin House. Eaton and Timberlake developed a friendship, and when the latter needed help to resolve a financial issue arising from his losses when the British captured the USS President in 1815, Eaton sponsored a bill in 1820 to relieve him. The relief bill failed. Timberlake then served with Matthew Perry on the USS Shark. In 1824, Purser Timberlake boarded the USS Constitution for duty in the Mediterranean and gave Eaton power of attorney for the purchase and transfer of Franklin House. Timberlake died on board on April 2, 1828, but accounts differ on the cause. Some suggested it was pulmonary disease, while others suggested he died by suicide. In either case, John Eaton took the widowed Margaret O'Neill Timberlake as his bride on January 1, 1829, 2 months before Jackson was inaugurated. As Eaton was nominated and confirmed as Secretary of War, rumors about the couple were already swirling in Washington. Cabinet members, the wives of cabinet members, and Washington's social elites shunned Margaret Eaton, whom they believed was an adulteress. Members of Jackson's own family, Andrew and Emily Donelson, ostracized her. As a result, Emily no longer served as First Lady, and was replaced by Jackson's daughter-in-law, Sarah York Jackson. Coincidentally, Jackson's request for an overall accounting of the Navy naturally included an investigation into John Timberlake's finances while he served as purser aboard the USS Constitution. The investigation coincided with the spurning of Margaret Eaton, creating a perfect storm for Jackson. He preferred to opponents of Eaton as creating an unholy, wicked, and unjust conspiracy, and as political combinations of slanderers. Jackson's rage over the affair seeps into his correspondence throughout 1830 and 1831. Jackson's first step in response to this perceived injustice was to replace the cabinet. On April 18, 1831, Martin Van Buren and John Eaton submitted their resignations. The following day, Jackson resolved to reorganize his cabinet, this being the only course looking to justice to all, and asked Secretary of the Navy John Branch to resign. Branch resigned effective May 12, 1831. Secretary of State Martin Van Buren left May 23. Secretary of the Treasury Samuel Ingham, Secretary of War Eaton, and Attorney General John Berrien all left their positions in the middle of June. Only Postmaster General William Berry remained. Edward Livingston replaced Van Buren as Secretary of State. Lewis McLean was recalled from his post as Minister to England to serve as Secretary of the Treasury. Lewis Cass, Governor of the Michigan Territory since 1813, replaced Eaton. Roger Brooke Taney became Attorney General. For Secretary of the Navy, Jackson selected the former New Hampshire Governor, Levi Woodbury. As Jackson wrote to General John Coffey, who had served under Jackson during the War of 1812, "All my friends must be abandoned by me." Included in that list of friends was Branch. A few weeks after the resignations became effective, Jackson again wrote to Coffey, "The conduct of Branch has been dishonorable in the extreme. He ran away, or at least left me, in apparent friendship, the very day before the publication reached here of his letter, shook me by the hand in friendship. I hate a hypocrite." Unlike the first cabinet, none of the replacements, except for Livingston, were sitting senators. This suggests that Jackson wanted a cabinet unaffiliated with the Washington social life, one that might show impartiality to Eaton and his wife should they return. A month after the election of the new Congress, Jackson delivered the president's constitutionally mandated annual message on the State of the Union. Jackson was cognizant of peace with European powers and the benefit that the Atlantic Ocean provided in a natural national defense. "We have nothing to apprehend from attempts at conquest," he wrote. Jackson understood the reality of attempts at conquest and potential threats to American sovereignty by European powers. He also understood that the United States had no means of conquering territories overseas. Marines remained bound to the ships on which they served and only intermittently in the country's short history had landed ashore. As a member of the U.S. Military Philosophical Society after the First Barbary War, Jackson was familiar with Eaton's expedition in North Africa that had included a few Marines among the far more numerous Arab and Greek mercenary forces intended to overthrow the Bashaw of Tripoli. Aside from a few incursions since the American Revolution, the size of the corps did not support conquering foreign territory and holding it. The army was larger, but focused on the westward expansion of the nation. In addition, the nation had no transport ships to carry sufficient troops to any distant shore. The only countries with smaller populations that the army could theoretically conquer were in the Western Hemisphere. Mexico was the obvious choice, and less than a decade after Jackson left office, the country would mount one of the largest amphibious operations in history prior to Gallipoli during the First World War. In the case of Britain, the greatest naval power at the time, Jackson wrote of, renewing our endeavors to provide against the recurrence of causes of irritation. Jackson fully understood the need for a navy that was adequate to protect the coast, always afloat rather than in port, and sufficiently resourced to build it up quickly in case of war. He stated that it was not the army that would protect the country, but the navy, which furnished the power by which all such aggressions may be prevented or repelled. Jackson had clearly stated his practical vision for the Navy: to direct more funds to preserve warships already built and provide materials for future ships. Despite the cabinet crisis in which Jackson demanded the resignations of several officials, his first term was largely successful. The Department of the Navy's finances were in a better state than in 1829. Ships benefited from additional maintenance, squadrons conducted diplomatic missions, and guarded against threats to American commerce. Jackson won the presidential election of 1832 with 54% of the popular vote and 219 electoral votes against Henry Clay's 49. Despite this, Jackson's party lost control of the Senate, even as he faced a constitutional crisis in which he would call upon the Navy. Jackson entered office with goodwill, grand expectations from the citizenry, and dedicated support. He had a clear sense of governance that was imbued with a sense of justice, his own, honor and fiscal accountability and responsibility. All those factors played important roles in how he managed his Navy. But Jackson chose his domestic political battles poorly, whether it was the Eaton affair or failing to work with Congress on the Second Bank of the United States. These personal shortcomings filtered down to the Navy in a government that was unable to devote more energy to the sea service. However, despite the often chaotic machinations in the Capitol or his personal failings, Jackson managed to adapt and develop the Navy, professionalizing its ranks and preparing its ships in the eventuality of a conflict. Secretaries of the Navy. One Jacksonian-era naval historian writes of the president's three secretaries of the Navy. Each was selected for political reasons, and each played an unimaginative and bureaucratic role as head of the department. This is arguable. They were politicians, but so have been most Navy secretaries, a tradition that carries through into the 21st century. All three had executive experience that would be useful as the head of the department. As senators, they would have been familiar with some policy issues, and especially budgets and appropriations. In nominating his secretaries, therefore, Jackson may have been more methodical and conscious of their requisite knowledge and organizational stability than previously thought. None of Jackson's choices for Navy secretary had military service at sea. The Navy was so small that comparatively few Americans had the opportunity to serve in it. Even fewer public officials had experience with it. The first Secretary of the Navy, Benjamin Stoddart, for example, had been in the tobacco trade and understood trade routes, ship logistics, cost of materials, and so on. William Jones, the fourth Secretary of the Navy, 1813-14, had apprenticed in a Philadelphia shipyard during the American Revolution and went to sea. Each of Jackson's three secretaries had served as governors and senators, thus bringing executive and legislative experience with them to the position. Jackson's first choice for Secretary of the Navy was John McLean, a New Jersey native who, like Jackson, had moved west to Virginia, Kentucky, and then Ohio. A former member of Congress, he served on the Ohio Supreme Court and as Postmaster General under Presidents Monroe and Adams. During the election of 1828, he threw his support behind Jackson and received the offers of both Secretary of the Navy and Secretary of War, declining both, He received Jackson's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court just 2 days after the inauguration and was confirmed on the following day. John Branch served as the first of Jackson's 3 secretaries of the Navy. A North Carolinian, he served in that state's legislature and as its Speaker of the House, 1815-17, before serving a 3-year term as governor. Branch then served in the Senate until assuming his office in the administration on March 9, 1829. Branch was a planter and lawyer with neither naval experience nor merchant experience with the shipping industry. Arguably, Jackson's choice for Secretary of the Navy was uninspired. Branch was a political appointee and someone Jackson could trust. As a North Carolinian, he was from a state that lacked the maritime tradition of some other colonies or states. Within days of assuming the office, he and Jackson would be called upon to deploy ships. Despite Branch's inexperience, he recognized the need for changes. First, his clerks were holdovers from the previous administration. Second, he shared Jackson's intent for fiscal reform. He fully believes that great abuses exist in the disbursement of public money under the rules or customs, recalled Amos Kendall from a meeting on March 27, 1829. Branch referred to them as derangements in finances. Despite being elected as an anti-elitist populist representing a Democratic wave, Jackson relied only on longtime politicians for the top administration positions. More specifically, most were senators. It is possible that these were the individuals whom he knew and trusted since he served in that chamber. It is also possible that since their home state legislatures elected all senators, Jackson was attempting to shore up political support. None were businessmen who might have dealt with merchant ships conducting a regional or global commerce. Jackson's second Secretary of the Navy, Levi Woodbury, was sworn in May 23, 1831. The New Hampshire native had served as the state's Speaker of the House, Governor, and then in the U.S. Senate before serving as Secretary of the Navy until June 30, 1834, when he became Secretary of the Treasury. With only a staff of 10 civilians, including the Secretary and clerks, officers of naval stations were largely responsible for daily management of the Navy. Navy Secretary Woodbury, however, recognized the structural role of others who were employed by the Navy but held no military rank. This class included naval agents, storekeepers, builders, schoolmasters, engineers, live oak superintendents, and others. The Navy hired all these personnel on an ad hoc basis. Woodbury suggested that they instead be subject to congressional regulation and compensation. Jackson's third Secretary of the Navy was Milan Dickerson of New Jersey, where, like his 2 predecessors, he had served as both governor and U.S. senator. The Jackson secretaries were knowledgeable, had some vision, and were amenable to the suggestions of their officers. Each made important progress unique to their tenure. Branch, for example, expected Amos Kendall to restore fiscal accountability. Woodbury used the budget to advance needed fleet repairs. His efforts to create a civil service recognized challenges and anticipated future needs. From a geostrategic perspective, he recommended the construction of 2 supply ships for the Pacific Station, thus reducing freight and storage costs and recognizing the permanency of the squadron. Moreover, the secretaries helped professionalize the officer corps. Dickerson inherited a fleet that was ready for battle, at least against like-sized powers, and he saw the advantage of steam warships. In his first annual report to Congress, 6 months after confirmation, he wrote, "It can hardly be doubted that the power of steam is soon to produce as great a revolution in the defense of rivers, bays, coasts, and harbors as it has already done in the commerce, intercourse, and business." He recognized that the ability to have steam warships as a means of defense would diminish costly coastal fortifications. If Dickerson was wrong, it was in his prediction that, because steam warships were too cumbersome to transport overseas for offensive operations, they would diminish the frequency of war. Although steamships capable of transoceanic voyage were not possible at that time, the capability might be possible in the future. In his 1835 annual report, Dickerson also recognized geostrategic threats such as those posed by Mexico and several South American nations and recommended increasing the Navy by 2 frigates, 3 sloops of war, and 4 steam vessels. By 1836, he thought the Navy could have 25 ships at sea. He later recognized the need for a new foundry to cast iron cannons as well as a national observatory, fundamental for navigation. Certainly, each secretary had limitations due to the uncertainty of the sometimes volatile president or their lack of naval experience, but they did each contribute to the Navy's evolution during the Jackson administration. The Board of Navy Commissioners. The Department of the Navy in the early Republic had very few full-time employees. The Secretary of the Navy remained responsible for personnel, operations, and some administration. To assist the Secretary, a Board of Navy Commissioners had been established at the end of the War of 1812. The Board was comprised of 3 senior officers nominated by the President and confirmed by the Senate. Their duties included procurement of naval stores and materials, construction, armament, equipment, repair and preservation of naval vessels, establishment of regulations, preparation of estimates of expenditures, and supervision of Navy yards, naval stations, and Navy agents. A president governed the board. For most of the board's existence, it was disestablished in 1842. The president was Commodore John Rogers, who presided from 1815 to 24, and again from 1827 to 37. A veteran of the quasi-war with France, the Barbary Wars, and the War of 1812, Rogers and Jackson were both resident members of the Columbian Institute for the Promotion of Arts and Sciences, founded by naval surgeon Dr. Edward Cutbush in 1816. It evolved into the U.S. Botanic Gardens at the foot of the Capitol by 1838. The board faced a challenge to its charter early in Jackson's first term. A Senate resolution sought to modify the Board of Navy Commissioners to make the Secretary of the Navy the presiding officer of the board and limit the tenures of the members. This would have been a radical change in governance had it succeeded. The Committee on Naval Affairs considered the resolution, as well as a report issued by Senator Nathaniel Silsby of Massachusetts. Silsby was a rarity on the committee, or the Senate as a whole, as he had gone to sea, rising to ship's captain, ship owner, and merchant from Salem. He had been a 2-term House member before being elected to the Senate in 1826 to fill a vacancy as a Federalist, later Whig. In addition to his sea service, he was the son-in-law of Benjamin Crowninshield, who had been the Secretary of the Navy from 1815 to 1818, and under whom the Board of Navy Commissioners was created. The committee did not perceive it necessary to make the proposed changes. Central to the committee's argument was that the resolution failed to specify whether the Secretary would have superintendence over proceedings of the Board, or whether he would simply cast a vote. Regarding limiting the tenure of the officers, the committee recognized that officers of the board needed to understand a variety of subjects: construction, tactics, budgets, personnel, contracts, and so on. Rotating officers among the Navy's senior officers infused fresh perspectives, yet the board still recognized the need for experience. The secretary waited until November 1829 to comment. This was unusual, but could have been caused by one or more of 3 factors. First, other issues of higher importance might have distracted the administration. Second, the Navy itself or its supporters might have quietly made their objections known. Third, Jackson and his supporters in the Senate might have preferred not to expend political capital on this subject. Branch's letter on November 13 was not to the Senate committee, but rather to the Board of Navy Commissioners itself to provide guidance. He wrote that the Navy organization was susceptible of improvement, particularly in its fiscal branch, its forms of administration, and the distribution of its duties. He may have been in line with Jackson's own thoughts when he proposed a radically different scheme of department organization. Branch also invoked Jackson's position when he advised the commissioners that he would have to submit any ideas to the president first. Such a statement empowered the commissioners. This was not unprecedented. Secretaries of the Navy, during and after the War of 1812, often consulted senior officers on issues such as force structure, but those had all been Federalist administrations. Branch's outreach, therefore, suggests that the administration would at least remain consistent with how it consulted with the officers. But such power was not unlimited. In one case, a senior naval officer was admonished. Branch wrote to Jackson, "I herewith transmit you a letter I have just received from Commodore Chauncey. He seems to be prematurely anticipating views of the executive." Taking advantage of the interest in their work, or perhaps quickly responding to ensure its ideas and not others were first proposed to the secretary, the commissioners provided a comprehensive reply only 10 days later. The commissioners, like the secretary, appeared to have recognized their own limitations as well. The duties of the Department of the Navy, they argued, were various and complicated. They stated that no one individual, however gifted, would be competent even to manage their general superintendence. Rogers suggested a revision to the department's organization based on 3 clear categories. Administrative functions included the traditional duties of the secretary, the execution of regulations, orders for the fleet, and coveting courts-martial. Ministerial functions focused on provisioning the fleet and ensuring an appropriate infrastructure at Navy Yards. Financial duties required a particular expertise in accounts and laws affecting expenditures. Since the position was created in 1798, the Secretary of the Navy had responsibilities for administrative and ministerial duties. Financial duties, however, fell to the accountant for the Navy, who was under the charge of the Secretary of the Treasury. Rogers recognized inherent financial inefficiencies in the Navy. He noted, for example, that it was regular occurrence for ships costing hundreds of thousands of dollars to require expenditures of up to $40,000 to correct errors in the structure and internal arrangements of a ship. There were errors arising solely from the absence of professional knowledge. Regarding improvement to the organization, he was entirely pragmatic in his analysis. He believed the duties of the Secretary of the Navy might improve through the addition of books in his office on a variety of topics that he might consult. Rogers meant not only books on history and geography, but also books on the state and condition of the Navy, so that he could answer any call from the President or from Congress without delay. He suggested instead that the board develop specialties so that each officer held defined fields of expertise, a notion previously not considered in the Navy. One member would be responsible for building, repairing, and equipping warships. A second would supervise the construction of docks, arsenals, storehouses, and other shore-based facilities. The third member would oversee the provisioning of food, supplies, and clothing for the Navy. Clearly, the proposal had an impact on Branch. On January 21, 1830, Branch transmitted a plan to the chair of the Committee on Naval Affairs of the House for the reorganization of the Board of Naval Commissioners. Navy and naval were used interchangeably when referring to the board. The draft legislation echoed Rogers' recommendations about dividing responsibilities of the members, one to build, equip and arm, and repair vessels of war, a second connected with the establishment and construction of facilities on shore, and a third for naval supplies. The impact of this legislation should not be underestimated. This was the first time anyone had envisioned such a division. It set the Navy down the path a decade later to abolish the Board of Navy Commissioners and establish the bureau system that was in place from 1842 through 1966, eventually giving way to the systems commands that still administer the Navy in the 21st century. There was logic to having the accountant of the Navy not actually serve under the Department of the Navy and the Secretary. Undue influence could occur from the Secretary in cases of financial discrepancies. Instead, the law required that the individual serve in the Treasury Department as the fourth auditor. As noted earlier, Rogers argued the necessity for an expert who understood finances and federal laws governing the budget. For this position, Jackson selected Amos Kendall, who had no experience in the topic. Kendall's pro-Jackson newspaper, the Argus of Western America, helped carry the state of Kentucky for Jackson in 1828. In his articles, Kendall and others defended Jackson from adultery charges. The editor came to Washington seeking a position so he could help Jackson reform the government. When Kendall moved to Washington after the election, he sought a clerkship or auditorship. In a private interview with Jackson on February 14, the president assured him of a position as the head of a department. Kendall understood that to mean an auditorship, which would pay $3,000 per year. His nomination was held back several weeks along with other controversial appointees to avoid the hostility that would have arisen had he sent them immediately to the Senate, then in special session. Half of the federal positions at the time were in the Treasury Department, therefore it made sense that Kendall would find an assignment there. He received his commission as fourth auditor overseeing Navy accounts on March 21st and began work 2 days later. In his autobiography, Kendall later admitted that he was totally ignorant of the process by which the Navy settled accounts. Nevertheless, Kendall possessed a sharp, inquisitive mind that quickly adapted to the accounting system. His efforts made an immediate impact on the Navy. The decision to select Kendall for the position is curious given his lack of experience, but Jackson had ushered in a new era of government patronage. Party loyalists were rewarded for their work in the election, and Kendall was in the top tier. Jackson apparently had faith in Kendall, and perhaps that is the reason he selected him to oversee the accounts of the Navy, which had had discrepancies in the previous administration. Correcting those discrepancies was a priority for the new president, particularly since the last fourth auditor, Tobias Watkins, would find himself charged with fraud in April. 2 weeks after assuming his duties, Kendall referred to his work and Watkins in a letter to his wife. "I have been so busily employed for some days in ferreting out some of the villainous transactions of my predecessor and others, formerly in the office here, that I have had little time for anything else." Kendall later recalled, "A few individuals of doubtful integrity or dissolute habits were removed from office, and their places supplied with political friends. It was soon rumored that frauds and corruptions had been detected in the late incumbents, verifying the worst suspicions of those who had opposed the last administration." Watkins was fined $3,000 and would serve 9 months in jail for failing to pay. By the end of Kendall's first year in the position, he estimated he had saved $800,000 in the Navy Department, a sum representing two-thirds of the total savings of the government. In November 1829, Secretary Branch asked Kendall to assess the causes of the financial mismanagement and the current laws and regulations to determine if they needed modification. "Money is the sinews of power and the source of corruption." English liberty had been considered safe only so long as the power of granting supplies to the king resides in the representatives of the people. "Our institutions have gone further. Here the representatives of the people not only grant supplies, but prescribe the objects to which they shall be applied, and the manner in which the accounts shall be kept." The financial accounting system was inefficient. No one, Kendall argued, could provide accurate information due to the poorly managed records. Nevertheless, Kendall did offer possibilities for reform. First, he recommended making the pay between the Navy and the Army officers equal. At the time, Navy officers were paid less than their Army counterparts. Second, He recommended specific line-item accounting for all congressional appropriations. Kendall proved his worth to Jackson, not only regarding Navy reform, but throughout the two administrations, as one of his closest and most loyal advisors. According to a biographer, Jackson trusted and expected only a few individuals to report to him directly. One of those was Kendall. The efficiency with which he carried out his work may have led to the administration's effort to review the position and how the Navy administered its own finances. By late 1833, the Secretary of the Navy suggested in his annual report to Congress that the duties of the fourth auditor be transferred to the Department of the Navy, given its close alignment. Although it was not adopted at that time, it set the stage for the later creation of the position of Navy Comptroller. Congress. Though Jackson dominated the era, he could not have done so as effectively without majorities in Congress, at least for most of his administration. If it did not share his interests, at least it did not oppose him regarding the Navy. However, in contrast to the House, the Senate was more likely to assert itself as a legislative body against the executive branch, as was the case with the reorganization of the Board of Navy Commissioners. Although Jackson was denied the presidency in the election of 1824, like-minded supporters flooded the new Congress, and their number continued to grow when he was finally inaugurated 4 years later. The early Republic's Congress consisted largely of businessmen and farmers who could not afford more than a few years away in Washington. In addition, congressional sessions were short, just a few months out of every year, as opposed to the nearly year-round sessions of the modern era. Members, therefore, gained little experience on issues, much less on the rules that governed that body. Nevertheless, members were familiar with the local militia system that had been in place since the Revolution. Consequently, most members primarily focused on the Army, which offered the immediacy of protection as the American population advanced toward the Mississippi River and south through Florida. The size of the country's standing army was only 6,000 during Jackson's first administration. In the absence of war, its greatest challenge was desertion. The Army experienced more than 8,000 desertions between 1823 and 1831. In 1831 alone, 1,450 soldiers deserted. Thus, Jackson and Congress understood that the Army had more immediate needs than the Navy. In 1830, for example, a report to the Congress suggested that a force of 12,500 was required for a permanent peacetime army. Congressional activity on naval issues was minimal during Jackson's first term. A review of the Register of Debates in Congress for 1829 and 30 indicates that the Senate, as a whole, did not discuss any naval issues. The House debated only a few issues, such as an exploring expedition. Like the previously mentioned attempt to modify the Board of Navy Commissioners, discussions appeared only in the committee process and never culminated in a vote on the floor of the House or Senate. Congressional committees also inhibited understanding the Navy. Committees were the gatekeepers who reviewed every legislative proposal and gave it their approval or disapproval. Although the nation had established a Navy in 1798, a Navy that had acquitted itself well during the Quasi-War, Barbary War, and War of 1812, Congress did not establish committees on naval affairs until 1816 in the Senate and 1822 in the House. Key committees could not establish expertise in naval affairs given their comparatively short tenures in office. Chairs of the Naval Affairs Committee had similarly abbreviated periods of service. Prior to 1846, chairmen of the Senate Naval Affairs Committee served on average only 6 months on the committee prior to assuming the chairmanship. In the House, it was 1.3 years. This compares to 8.9 years and 6.9 years in the Senate and House, respectively, between 1875 and 1945. In the 21st century, members might be in the Senate for decades before becoming chair, and then another decade in committee leadership. Once they had become a chair in the early republic, however, a member would only spend a little over 2 years in the position. Despite the lack of political experience, members knew to listen to constituents. One such example was the South Seas Exploring Expedition. While Jackson was on his journey to his 1829 inauguration, the Senate continued considering sending an expedition to the Pacific. The proposal had been the brainchild of Ohio publisher and explorer Jeremiah Reynolds. The purpose, as it evolved, was to survey the northwest coast of the U.S. territories and the Pacific. Such an endeavor would support the American whaling fleet with navigational information and eventually expand trade with the Orient. On January 22, 1829, Senator Robert Young Hayne, Republican, South Carolina, wrote to Adams Secretary of the Navy, Samuel Southard, requesting additional information. Hayne, chairman of the Senate Committee on Naval Affairs, had just been re-elected after serving a term as a Jacksonian. Like many cabinet members, Hayne had served in the War of 1812 and held a variety of elected positions, including Speaker of the South Carolina House of Representatives and State Attorney General. Like the cabinet, he had no experience with the Navy. His tenure in the Senate would be abbreviated in 1832 when he became governor. On behalf of the committee, Hayne asked for clarification on several issues regarding the proposed expedition. First was the issue of expenses already incurred preparing for the expedition, as well as estimates for future expenditures and personnel involved. Second, the committee worried about the extent of the expedition's goals and if it might take several expeditions. Southard referred to a resolution of the House of Representatives from May 21, 1828, stating that the expedition was to examine the coasts, islands, harbors, and reefs in those seas and ascertain the true situation. The country's nautical charts were extremely inaccurate, endangering the safe travel of both commercial and naval ships. Southard reported that whalers believed there were at least 200 island reefs and shoals that were not noted on any American chart. The Navy proposed sending only one of its smallest ships, the sloop Peacock, for this assignment. Supernumeraries would include an astronomer, naturalists, draftsmen, surveyors, and someone to assess the state of commerce in the Pacific. The Navy intended to enlist experienced deckhands from the whaling centers of Nantucket and New Bedford, and had already sent out recruiters. The Navy made repairs to the Peacock, contacted scientists, and consulted Americans with experience in the Far East. In short, the Navy had laid the essential groundwork should the expedition receive approval. The House of Representatives had already authorized $50,000 for the expedition. But the Peacock alone, the Navy knew, could not conduct the expedition in its entirety because of the extent of territory involved in this mission. Less than 2 weeks before Jackson's inauguration, the House and Senate differed on the expedition. Hayne reported to the committee that the House had expected the Senate to concur with the House's resolution without due consideration. Hayne recommended delaying action on the resolution in favor of a future, much larger and more expansive project. Hayne appeared to have argued that the cost of rebuilding, repairing, and fitting out the expedition, in addition to expense of maintaining it for 3 years, was very considerable. More troubling to Hayne was the fact that the Navy had progressed so far with its preparations without Senate concurrence on spending. Constitutionally, the Navy was supposed to react to congressional guidance, not initiate it. He found further investigation was necessary. The committee could not support the proposal and suggested instead the country had too many unsettled and unexplored regions at home. The country had to push westward and take the lands up to the Pacific coast before such a maritime endeavor could begin. Hayne and the committee recognized the opportunities an expedition offered, such as the possibility of discovering new islands that might serve as the foundation for an American colony. The report also referred to Washington's warning in his farewell address that the country should avoid entangling alliances. He cautioned against a spirit of adventure without an abandonment of the fundamental principles of policy, and a departure from those wise and prudent maxims which have hitherto restrained us from forming unnecessary connections abroad. Asserting senatorial privilege, Hayne proposed a resolution that Jackson provide a detailed statement on the preparations for an expedition. However, Jackson had other concerns with the Navy and the country. The expedition would have to wait another 8 years, when a 6-ship force finally weighed anchor for a 4-year cruise. The midterm election of 1830 had mixed results for Jackson. In the Senate, Jacksonians continued to hold a 2-seat majority over the anti-Jacksonians. In the House, however, Jacksonians lost 10 seats. Like the Congress of 1829 and 30, the new Congress spent little time debating naval issues. Instead, it focused on domestic and fiscal issues, such as the post office and tariffs. When Congress did raise naval issues, it tended to focus on pay. Jacksonians supported increasing the pay of master's commandant, but not of lieutenants, thereby furthering distinguishing between the two ranks. This was the first indication of a clear separation of those ranks, particularly since the master commandant would evolve into the rank of commander by 1838. As part of the administration's expectation for accountability in the Navy, regulations were proposed that governed prices for necessary articles on board ships, thereby providing consistency and professionalizing the role of purser. The budget. One of the clearest pieces of evidence that show a presidential administration's priorities is the annual budget. This was no less true of Jackson. He inherited a naval budget in 1829 of $3 million. His last budget of 1837 was more than $5 million. A fiscally conservative president less inclined to support the Navy would not have increased its budget by 270% in only 8 years. Yet, the spending categories within the budget were not consistently increased. They were subject to changing circumstances, such as the Second Seminole War late in Jackson's administration, the construction of new ships, particularly the costly ship of the line USS Pennsylvania, and improving pay for active duty personnel. Jackson entered his first term with the intent to hold the Navy Department fiscally accountable and adjust for perceived mismanagement. The full effect of a president's budget is felt approximately 18 months after taking office, as the first budget is inherited from the predecessor. Jackson, for example, modestly increased the budget in 1830. However, after receiving reports from Fourth Auditor Kendall and having a full understanding of naval spending, Jackson responded at the first opportunity to impose austerity measures. From 1830 to 1831, the Navy budget decreased 25%. This was achieved by slashing the budget for repairs and improvements at the Navy yards by nearly 50%, although it was restored the following year, and for provisions by more than 60%, and by zeroing out ordnance procurements for 1 year. These cuts were accompanied by moderate increases in some categories, such as naval pay. By December 1833, Jackson felt confident enough with federal spending that he could respond to an earlier Senate proposal to equalize the pay of officers of the Army and Navy. One method of achieving this was to decrease the pay of senior officers. The senior Army officer held the rank of Major General, while the Navy would not have the rank of Admiral until the Civil War. Its senior captain, while afloat, would receive the same pay as the Major General, for example. Naval pay became a major component of his professionalization of the sea service, with an increase of 270% from 1829 to 1837. By 1835, because of the boom in revenues due to public land sales, partly due to reducing their price, the president did what no other president in U.S. history achieved. He balanced the budget and eliminated the federal debt. This enabled Jackson to then focus on new budget priorities, such as those for the Navy. In addition to naval pay, Jackson reinvested in improvements at Navy Yards, spending nearly $1.2 million in 1836 and 1837 alone. He also invested in the repair and construction of ships, as well as in a return to pre-1830 levels for ordnance. Admittedly, ordnance would be a higher budget item in 1836 and 1837 because of the Second Seminole War. The benefits of these investments and adjustment of priorities are discussed in the following chapters. Jackson's governance was guided by a clear sense of where America should go, to the sea, to engage in global commerce to spur the economy. He understood that the Navy was required not only to protect U.S. merchant ships, but to conduct reprisals if necessary. It is clear from inauguration speeches and his annual addresses to Congress that he believed the Navy must advance technologically and increase in size. To do so, he first had to address budget issues, which he accomplished. Due to his personal sense of justice, Jackson held the Navy accountable for transgressions by sailors and officers. He was more involved in court-martial reviews, discussed in a later chapter, than any president before him or after him through the presidency of James Buchanan. But Jackson's personal emotions could cloud a more logical and fair approach to an issue. Jackson did much during his two terms, especially for and with the Navy. Nevertheless, some of his efforts were marred or stunted by self-inflicted political wounds based on a poor temperament. These included his reaction to the Eaton affair, nullification, and the Bank of the United States. It would be simply speculative to suggest what he might have accomplished with the Navy without these distractions to his governance. One historian contends that there is no evidence that Jackson and his supporters devoted a substantial amount of time, reflection, or discussion to naval policy. At face value, this statement is correct. There are no recorded discussions of policy, nor are there substantive letters from Jackson to his secretaries of the Navy on issues. But despite the paucity of direct correspondence, it should not be taken there were no discussions or no thought. Public statements like annual addresses and reports point to the contrary, and actions speak louder than words. Subsequent chapters on platforms, operations, and personnel will show what was achieved.